From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, Beth Dean returns to the show, this time to talk about designing with emotional intelligence. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Visual Chefs, a versatile web development agency with expertise in content management system and custom web application development. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Visual Chefs propels the web forward. Visit visualchefs.com to learn more.
Today, we're really excited to have our friend Beth Dean back on the show. Beth is an illustrator and designer who works at Facebook on transparency, and she recently served as a White House Tech and Innovation Fellow. Welcome back to the show, Beth.
Hi, ladies.
I'm so excited to have you back here. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so I've been at Facebook for about 2 years. I've worked mostly in business products. Right now, I work on a team called Ads Transparency and Control, and that's how we tell people how their information is used for advertising and give them controls around their privacy. And I also spent some time working on Facebook's authentic names issue, which I can get into a little more later. But yeah, before that, I spent a long time working at larger companies like Progressive Insurance, American Greetings, and Expedia. And I've worked at a bunch of startups too. So I've kind of seen a lot of different sizes and shapes of design problems and users. So I feel like that gave me a pretty interesting perspective coming to Facebook.
And what is this White House Tech and Innovation Fellow? What was that?
So that was through an organization called Lesbians Who Tech. And this was their second year doing that. And they invited a bunch of representatives from all over tech, all over the country. So you have people who were product managers, engineers, designers, all coming to the White House to work on specific problem spaces. So some people worked on social justice issues, like around using like crime and police data to solve things like police violence, and also to just like open up government data. I work specifically on diversity and inclusion. And then I think that there was a live Google Hangout from the White House with all of the projects afterwards.
Wow. Did you meet the president?
I didn't. He was on vacation, which meant that a lot of the White House is under construction. They do all the repairs when he is gone. I was surprised to find that they had less security than Facebook. So I wandered around a little bit and I found a bowling alley.
Oh, exciting. I've heard about that. Wasn't that Nixon to put that in, I think?
It was either Nixon or no, it was Eisenhower, because it's called the Eisenhower Bowling Alley, but they moved it. It was in like a state of disrepair. And I think Reagan paid to have it moved to, I can't remember the name of the building, but there's like the building where basically the work happens that's attached to the White House. And it has again fallen into disrepair, and Obama tried to fix it and people were mad that he was going to spend money on a bowling alley. So it's, it remains as is.
Oh my goodness. I mean, it feels like you kind of gave us a little bit of a background in your professional life, but then more recently, you're working on a lot of social issues and such. Is that sort of like bled into your actual everyday work? Or was that always something that you've thought about and considered when you design or develop or do your job?
That's a good question. You know, I don't think it was something that I always considered, but I realized about a year ago that it was actually kind of this running theme in the background of my work that I maybe wasn't aware of until then. Like, I realized a lot of the things I had found the most frustrating at previous jobs were when I felt like I couldn't do the right thing for the person using my product. And usually the right thing was something around, you know, ethics. Like, an interesting thing about working in insurance is it's a product that's legally mandated by the government. So nobody wants to buy it. It's intangible. So it's not like a thing you can even, you know, hold in your hands. And you only use it when something goes very wrong. So people don't like it to begin with. And it's in an insurance company's best interest to not be very transparent about how it works. One reason for that is that, you know, they don't want customers to think about all the ways that they're getting charged for their rate, but also they don't want their competitors to know because every insurance company rates a little bit differently. They just use the parameters that the state defines within their regulations. So they kind of have like some boundaries and then they choose what they want from there. So it was really weird to work in a space where we were intentionally not transparent with customers. And so I kind of had a moment about Yeah, a little over a year ago at Facebook, where I started working on this issue of authentic identity. And it really was like a lightning kind of moment where I realized this had been in the background of all of my work. Like, something that was really important to me was doing the right thing for people. And also, no one's necessarily going to let you do that. It's often an organizational challenge. Like, you have to help people understand what the right thing to do is and why they should do it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So today we're going to talk about something called emotional intelligence. And I think it relates very clearly to what you were just describing. But for our listeners, can you just describe what emotional intelligence is in general?
Yeah. So I looked up like a handy dictionary definition so I could give you a more clean description than the way that I would talk about this. But it's essentially the capacity to be aware of, control, and express your emotions and how to handle interpersonal relationships with empathy. And I think the way that that relates to software design is just taking into account the feelings a person might be experiencing as they're using your application. And these feelings could be triggered by the software itself, or it could just be like the situation that they're in their life at that moment.
And you mentioned how it can apply to software. Do you have thoughts about how it just applies to the broader experience of designing anything?
Well, I guess you might not see it as much in graphic design. Maybe it depends on the space that you're designing for. Like, I can imagine this is something very important in the service design of a hospital, right?
Right.
Like, I think there was a really great special. I can't remember whether it was Frontline, but years ago, there was like an hour-long TV special about IDEO redesigning Kaiser's emergency room experience. And, you know, the people that are working there under tremendous pressure, the people that are there are at one of the most stressful moments of their lives. And then you just have a lot of people in this space all colliding with each other. So I don't think emotional intelligence is necessarily new to design, but I think we're at a place with software design where we're finally really having to think about it. One of the things I've been talking about in some of the speaking engagements I've had this year is how we took a long time to get to a place where we even had good data to validate our design choices. For a long time, it was like, you know, we just need to build something well and make it look good. And then something like Google Analytics came along and many other tools where we could actually measure the effectiveness of what we were doing. So we were really just thinking about, does this work? Does this work well? Does this look high quality? And now software is integrated into people's lives in a way it never was before. And we actually have to think about just how are people existing? They live their entire lives online now. And that means that they're using software in very emotionally vulnerable states sometimes, and that we have access to information when we're designing that we maybe never did before.
I find it really interesting, you know, how you did mention like, you know, emotionally intelligent design or just emotional intelligence in the professional workplace isn't anything particularly new. But I know for myself, like when I was being taught design principles or even just web stuff, everything was about let's make everyone as happy as possible in the baseline. And I feel like that was the extent of any consideration of people's emotional state, that everyone assumes that the baseline emotional state of the user is happy, and that the next level, the only emotionally intelligent design decision is to make them happier or to surprise them. But emotionally intelligent design, I assume, goes beyond that. So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah. So to kind of summarize what you were talking about, one of the ways I think we've approached software design for a really long time is that we don't want to create friction for people, right? Friction is frustration. If they go through an experience and there's a lot of friction, they're not going to be happy. And that sort of assumes that they're coming into our designs in a good place to begin with. And people aren't always. So when you think about why might I be checking my bank balance? Is it because I need to pay a bill and maybe there's not enough money in my bank account? Why am I logging into my insurance policy? Is it because I just had an accident? I feel like maybe the best way for me to describe this is by examples of where it's not working. Is that okay with you ladies?
Sounds good.
So one anecdote I have from when I worked in insurance. So like I was saying, insurance rating is very complicated. People generally don't understand it. They don't know why their rate costs what it does. So we were going to do a test where we wanted to show people their credit score as they went through the process of buying insurance, because we thought this would help them understand how we assessed what kind of risk they presented to us. And this sounded kind of good on the surface, right? We wanted to increase transparency and tell people a little bit more about how this was working. And when we got into the test, this woman was confronted with her score when she was not expecting it, and it was very low. And it turned out that she had been bankrupted a few years in the past by a huge medical catastrophe, and it just devastated her family, and they were living with the fallout of this for years, and she just was not expecting to be confronted with this number and burst into tears in the middle of our test. And, you know, we just thought, oh, more information is always better. You know, we had no idea the ramifications of such a thing, and I feel like a lot of people, designers today, are experiencing moments like that where they have this information and people are more vulnerable than they ever were before, and we just don't think about the impact of what it might be like to see things when we aren't expecting them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know other people have mentioned this before. I've seen people talk about it on Facebook, but I absolutely hate the here's a memory from your past thing.
Very contentious.
Yeah, it's, you know, just the other day something came up that I didn't want to see. And in order, first of all, I saw it on my phone and I couldn't do anything except tell it to don't show more of these in the future from my mobile device. Mm-hmm. So I went on the desktop to try and do more, and it literally makes you go through a year selection to black out years. You can't just like say, don't do this anymore. So I had to think back, what were the difficult years that I don't want to have to have these unexpected things come back? And it made me so angry. I was like, well, you have to let me opt out of this entirely. Why are you actually making me have to think even more about the bad memory that you just showed me?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. You have to like go down memory lane.
Yeah, I don't understand why that's something that they felt like you just got it. You didn't get to choose whether you wanted to opt into that. It was just like it's not even an opt out. You can opt out for some years, but God forbid you don't pick the right years.
I believe you can opt out of memories with specific people too. Like I got one the other day that was a photo of my mom. So, you know, a computer probably would look at that and think that is something that's really high quality. There was a lot of engagement. It's a nice photo, but it was a picture I posted of my mom saying every Mother's Day I get 1,000 marketing emails about moms and my mom is dead and I don't want them and there's no way to opt out. So this was like a memory to remind me of my unhappy memories.
Right.
And it just goes to show you can only do so much with an algorithm, right? Like computers are only as smart as we tell them to be. So I share your pain there.
I think you're right that we're living much more of our lives online in a personal way than ever before. And there are just more of these things that are showing themselves. You know, the service is assuming that you're going to want this thing. And I have to ask myself, why did they make that assumption? Like what was, because you going through that exercise with the woman with her credit score, like are people doing, you know, user testing and actually trying to test the emotional aspects and factor those in? Or are they going through rote tests of whether a task is completed?
Well, you know, for that specific team, I can't really speak to what they're doing because I don't work on that team. I think that in general, this is something that's still really new to people, right? To back up to the precursor to on this day, we had year in review. And year in review, the first year, it didn't go so great. Well, at least it didn't go so great for a few people. And year in review showed up on Christmas Eve and reminded some people of some very bad things that had happened with some confetti and some content that suggested, hey, you had a great year. Do you want to remember it? And not everybody has a great year. And I know that Facebook learned a lot from that. They've designed an experience that doesn't make so many assumptions. And I think on this day was kind of the next logical progression. So it is a little bit different, but I can't really talk to what bulletproofing that team is doing. But you know, it's like we're all just kind of learning these lessons. And the interesting thing about Facebook is because of the sheer scale of how we're designing, we hit these boundaries in human experience before many other products and services ever would. And that also means that what is a very small percentage of people for us is still a lot of people. So for my own design practice here, you know, I first was working on business tools. So it wasn't something I had to think about so much as, am I helping people get their jobs done? Am I helping them look good for their bosses? But when our issue with real names happened, I actually switched projects to go work on that. And I'm sorry, I actually shouldn't say real names. That's sort of the public name. Facebook calls it authentic identity. And that was when I realized that I really cared about this and had the opportunity to affect emotional design at scale at Facebook. And so when I transitioned off of that project, that was when I intentionally joined the team that I am on right now, which is a long-winded way of saying I'm only just now in a position to incorporate these ideas into the beginning of my process. Like before, it's been very reactive, like going back and fixing things mm-hmm. that maybe didn't work as right. well as they could. So I'm kind of charting new territory now and thinking about this at the beginning of all of my work.
So what does that look like for you? Is that something where you have like a list of things that you reference, or do you get together with other team members and brainstorm, or are you dealing with users to talk about things before you actually build something?
I'm only just now working on a project that I think is really, really going to take this into account, or I should say where it really, really, really matters. So it's sort of uncharted territory, but the things I've been thinking about are, how do we assess risk? Because it's pretty easy for me to look at something from my perspective and think about my own experiences and say, okay, this doesn't push any of the buttons that I have, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work for everybody, right? Especially when you have so many people using your products. So I've been thinking is if there's a way that I can maybe make some kind of like flowchart of questions I can ask myself just to identify where there might be points of risk and where mm-hmm. I might need to back up and think about the problem a little bit more. I also think just a really fundamental part of design process will help people with this, which is just thinking about what are the problems that you're actually trying to solve. Because I think a lot of times as designers, we either take shortcuts, try and make an experience easier, or think we're going to do like what Leia said, where we're going to surprise and delight somebody. But if that's not actually helping solve the user problem, we might just be introducing unnecessary risk into mm-hmm. the process. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been thinking about like, is there a list of questions I can ask myself? And then the other thing I think is really important is to just get something in front of as many different kinds of people as possible. And what I mean is like people who have really different backgrounds and experiences, because I can make a check and try and think about all the different types of trauma someone might have experienced in their life, but it's probably going to be incomplete and it's going to be biased towards my life and the life of people around me. So I think just getting different people who just have completely different backgrounds mm-hmm. Isn't going to solve the problem, but it's going to help you uncover issues faster, especially if you can test an end-to-end flow with them. Because I think about one experience I had was last year I was trying to book a cabin on Airbnb for my birthday. And I was having a really hard time. The first place I booked had to cancel because there was a wildfire. So it wasn't their fault, but they canceled at the last minute. And it's like 2 days before I'm supposed to leave and I've got to find a place. And I finally find something, even though the search filters aren't working. So I'm really like, I'm frustrated and I'm emotional because I'm like worried if my birthday is going to work out or not. And it tells me that this property requires I confirm my identity. And I'm like, okay, that's reasonable. You know, somebody's going to have another person up in their space. They want to make sure it's like a legit person. And so they give me some options to scan my ID, which I try two different ways and it fails, but it doesn't give me a very descriptive error message. So I'm like even more frustrated. And at this point, the app has sort of taken on a personality. I'm thinking that Airbnb is a person being mean to me. Like, I'm like, Airbnb, why aren't you letting me do this? Why are you trying to ruin my birthday? And like, no designer Airbnb wants to ruin my birthday. I've met some very nice people who work there, you know? And so the next step, it says, okay, there's another way you can verify your identity. You can answer some questions for us. And I'm thinking, okay, this will be really straightforward. And I think they scrape some government database. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you're like signing up for a new credit card and to confirm who you are, they ask you some things like, have you lived at this address?
So right.
It was one of those kind of things. But it was at that point that Airbnb asked me if I knew my dead mom. And, you know, the designers, they were probably thinking this is really standard information. They might not even have been thinking about what kinds of information that was going to be used. Because if it's some kind of like government database, you know, they're probably just like scraping things at random. So nobody would ever have thought in a million years that there would be something there that's contentious. But like, what if I didn't want to remember one of those places I lived? Because what if it was I lived there during a terrible marriage or something like that. Right. And I'm just trying to book a vacation house, man. And you're showing me this really awful stuff. I kind of got off on a tangent, but I think that with some user testing, if you had people who had a lot of different experiences and they really went through all of these stress paths in the application, because a lot of times a user test like assumes people are going to go down a specific linear flow, and that's not always the case. I think that some of those kinds of things could be sussed out. And I also think it's pretty important to try and understand any of the places your experience is going to go down a different branch than the happy path and test all of those too.
You know, you've talked a lot about the sort of emotional intelligence of designing for, I guess, avoiding the stress or the painful experiences. But is there a flip side of it? Is there an aspect of emotionally intelligent design that factors in for really positive experiences? And I don't know, perhaps leveraging that in some way to further a goal of a behavior on an app?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know if I've seen any examples of that. Do you mean kind of like a behavioral hook that just has really positive reinforcement?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it just, so much of this is really about the, I guess, quote unquote, negative aspects of an experience. But, you know, we also have the flip of that. And I just wonder if there's anything about furthering that or using it to, you know, if of identifying, you know, just like you're trying to identify where it might trigger someone to feel particularly stressed. Mm-hmm. Is there the flip side of that where you could identify where it might really, I guess, the surprise and delight thing that Leia was talking about, like continue emotionally positive experience?
Yeah, nobody's ever asked me that before. I get asked for examples or positive examples, and I'm hard pressed to find them. And I don't think it's because, you know, the state of design is terrible. I think this is just like really new territory and people are only just now starting to think about this. I can't think of any really interesting hooks, but I can think of a positive example of this. And it is Facebook. I'm not trying to shamelessly plug my own company, but, you know, Facebook has the custom gender option. You do not have to conform to a binary gender on Facebook. And this is reflected in the pronouns that the application shows. And it is even reflected in the way that you are advertised to, because some advertisers choose to target a specific gender. And I think a lot of this stuff, it ties back to identity, right? Like you don't really expect major experiences in your life to shape your identity. You think of your identity as kind of the sum of like your hobbies and where you're from and what your beliefs are. But when you have something really big happen, like your parent dying, that does become part of your identity. And when you are confronted with something in an application that conflicts with that identity, it feels like it's questioning the very core of your being. Mm-hmm. So when an application actually can support your identity, especially when you're used to most things not really being aware of that, I think that's an opportunity both to do the right thing and to add some delight. I hesitate to call it delight because that means that the bar is really low. People should expect to be supported in those ways, but I think that's an example of where things are going right.
I would think that there is another one that I can think of, is that maybe being more clear, because we're talking about Facebook, being more clear about the positive experiences that you do have on Facebook. And I kind of tweeted about this like a few months ago about how I absolutely love the Humans of New York Facebook page, and that whenever I read stuff there, even if it's sad, like my feeling towards humanity increases each time. And in terms of like making me feel better, if there were mechanisms to basically saying more of this, more of this, more of this, you know, that would be a positive way to affect, you know, emotional design. And another thing that's a little bit more subtle is that I do like the feature in Facebook where you can essentially say, I want to see updates from this person like first and more often. So, for example, I've starred all my sisters' Facebook posts so that the moment they've posted something, because I know, you know, social media always changes their algorithms and sometimes it's not related to timeline anymore or in a particular order, linear order. So, you know, having options where it's like, okay, I want to see more from people I actually really, really care about more often. I think that's an example of a good emotionally intelligent design decision. I think the challenge is, how do we make that more obvious?
Yeah, I think that goes back to kind of the core of Facebook's mission, which is you know, making the world more open and connected, but that's really deepening your connection with your sisters, right?
Right.
And I don't know, I feel like that's a really good mission, but there are times where I don't always want to be connected to everyone in the same way. And I think Facebook's doing a good job of giving us better controls, but it's funny to me because I think about how, you know, my family and I have really different ideas about politics.
Right.
And so when we get together, you know, we usually just don't discuss those. You know, we have a nice Thanksgiving dinner and talk about literally anything else. But somehow on social media, I can be confronted with all of that stuff and be reminded of all of the things that my family and I disagree about. And I have tools now to hide those things. But I'm like, wow, that actually makes me not want to see more stuff from them. But how do I still see things like when my brother posts updates about my nephew? So I think you're onto something with sort of these more like positive controls rather than just like hiding things that you don't like or filtering things. Like, how can you reinforce what is working well? Yeah. And I've been working on that a little bit with advertising too.
So we've talked a lot about Facebook, and I think it's a good example because it's the thing that didn't exist before, where we're engaged with technology, but in an extremely personal way. But I'm curious, where can emotionally intelligent design show itself in other online spaces? Like, let's talk about like a corporate website. It occurs to me that a lot of what we're talking about is ultimately to have your user, your customer, your visitor, whatever you want to label them, connect with you in a positive way. So that's in part avoiding creating friction for them. And then the other part, which is what I think Leah and you are talking about, is reinforcing the positive aspects. And so this seems fundamental to me to essentially marketing. You know, if you're trying to connect with an audience, that's the fundamental of how you do it. But thus far, I feel like a lot of websites and marketing efforts are focused on, you know, making sure that the site's branded and it reflects, you know, the brand of the company, which, you know, you draw the line that that reinforces trust and integrity, and that you're putting content out there that your audience can connect with. But what's beyond that in terms of like the design, the applying the emotional intelligence to a website experience and having those connections be positive and reduce the negative?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, because when I think about the places online where I've had maybe the most frustrating experiences, it's usually when I'm trying to do something kind of utilitarian, right? I'm going to my bank and the bank is very concerned with branding and upselling me credit cards, but they're less concerned with making it easy for me to transfer money or take things out of the ATM because maybe they want to upsell me stamps. So I think there's tremendous opportunity there. And I actually am pretty heartened with what I've been seeing in that space. It seems like the bar for tools and enterprise design in general is getting much higher. The expectations around that are that it should behave more like consumer software. But I think there's also like voice and tone opportunities too, right? Like you're always going to have sort of this, I guess what you see, and I'm just going to go to a bank for an example again, in my bank software isn't particularly terrible, so please don't think I'm picking on them. But you see sort of different product groups like duking it out within the application. Like you see marketing, you see whoever is like the product person responsible for these different sorts of like mortgage offers trying to get their things in there. So you see all of these things competing instead of a team of people thinking about what are the user goals and how do we put all of these things in here in a more natural way. But you also sometimes see a little bit of, you know, like this sort of marketing tone emerge where they assume you're coming in because you're happy and they want to make you more happy and they want you to buy more stuff and do more stuff. But there's also something to be said for just being kind of serious and not necessarily being dry, but just acknowledging that you're here to do a job and that you want to get some stuff done. And anything else on top of that is great, but that's not really why you're here. And I think that tone is starting to play a bigger role in a lot of these services. I mean, you see how huge Slack is now, and that's because people want like work software or tools to behave more like really fun consumer software. Like it's a little bit easier, I think, for consumer software to just be less frustrating because the stakes are lower, right? Like you don't necessarily have to use it. I mean, maybe with Facebook, you use that to stay connected, but with other things, you're using it because it's fun. And if it's frustrating, you can just abandon it. It's not like an integral part of your life. But with something like, you know, banking or insurance, like you've got to use that stuff. Like you don't have a choice. So I feel like that's that's shifting a little bit. But I think right now the biggest opportunity, since organizations aren't going to fundamentally change, is really nailing that voice and tone aspect.
And just to carry that thought a little bit further, I feel like a way that companies can begin to hit those notes appropriately is something you mentioned earlier, and that's having more diversity within their company. The teams that are building things are reflecting a broader range of voices that can bring their own experiences and thoughts to the process to guide everything from the marketing, the words that they're using, to defining the workflow of steps that someone has to get through to transfer money from one account to the other. And I think that that's something that Leigh and I are seeing more. We're appreciating the value of that more and seeing that that's something that really can help, you know, the people that, you know, Leigh and I work for, our clients, for them to do more with what they already have is to bring more perspectives into the process.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was kind of the foundation of some of the work I was doing at the White House. Like, you can't really make great products and services if you're not meeting everyone's needs. And mm-hmm. if you only have one type of people, that's not even a thing you can say, one type of person, it's early and I haven't had enough coffee, your experiences are going to be really narrow. You're going to make a product that works really well for one person mm-hmm. and not everybody else. And I think maybe not enough companies recognize the value in that yet, but I love that it's finally a conversation that seems to be at the forefront of design and development. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where that's at in like the next 3 to 5 years.
So I'm a little bit concerned in regards to the fact that we've been talking a lot about emotionally intelligent design and the space and user experience in particular, like content strategy. That's great. But a lot of the software that we're talking about is largely driven by developers. Is there anything that coders, developers, programmers need to consider, and what can they bring to the table to be more emotionally intelligent about the products that they're actually building?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question too. I've probably said that about all of your questions this morning. But I think something I've seen shifting is that developers are much more product-minded now, right? They care about the things that they're building, and they want to be involved earlier and earlier in the process, mm-hmm. at least the ones I'm working with. And I think that when they become a part of the design and product definition process, they're really aware of why they're building what they're building, and they're really understanding who they're building for much more. I mean, when I look back at the Airbnb experience, that seems like something that probably a developer did. Like, a designer probably came to a developer and was like, hey, what are ways we can verify somebody's identity? And the developer's like, I have access to this. Let's put it mm-hmm. in there. And like that may have been all the thought that was given. But if that developer had seen a bunch of user tests, or just even knew what the general like personas were of the people using that application, that may not have happened. So I feel like the blending of design and development mm-hmm. and just working really well cross-functionally. Yeah. I think there are a lot of designers that want to work really siloed, and they want to do their design work and toss it over to a developer. And, you know, maybe there's developers that like that. And they're like, don't bother me until you're telling me what to code. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think everybody working together really early, so everybody's really clear on what the value proposition is what's going to help solve that problem. And also make developers better at their jobs, because, you know, no developer just wants to be a code monkey, right? They mm-hmm. want to feel like they're building something really, really well. And that isn't just in the architecture of an application, right? It's like how people feel when they're done using it.
So is there training for this? Is this something that, you know, I know this is still kind of an emerging sector on the web, but do you just have like a giant team meeting with all stakeholders, including design and development? And then you just say, here's our goals. And part of our goals is to consider emotional intelligence.
Well, I think it depends on your team, right? So for me, it's like the way that I'm working is we do this thing called, like every big company probably does this, called like road mapping, where you sort of figure out like, what am I going to work on for the rest of the year? What are we going to accomplish like this half? And how will we know if we were successful? So the way that we do that on my team, and every team here is completely different, we get in a room together and we reevaluate like, what is our team mission? And we make sure that we're all in really, really clear agreement on that. And then we go from team mission to think about what are the problems that we need to solve to affect that mission. And, you know, people might have differing ideas, so there's a lot of back and forth. But the important thing is to, like, keep away from solutions thinking, like, early on in the process. And then everybody gets really clear on what the problems are we're trying to solve before people start proposing projects. And, you know, with emotional intelligence, sometimes I think it's, like, very project specific, but it's also something that just kind of has to be part of your toolkit. Like, as you're thinking about, does this look good? Does this work seamlessly? I think that's just another branch in that tree that you have to think about. But I also think there's opportunity when you're doing that product definition early on to identify where the gaps are and affect that. So there's a project I'm going to work on this year that I can't really talk about what it is yet, but I felt like there was a strong emotional need for this. And so, you know, I came to this meeting with some mock-ups for this and just showed the developers. I'm like, hey, this is why this is really important to me. I think this really affects people's feelings, and we have a huge opportunity here to do something really good and to set a great example for how to design with emotional intelligence for the rest of the company to follow. And they were really sold on that. So I think, you know, when you get developers involved really early in the process and they feel some ownership, they're going to respond really well. And I don't know if it's as simple as just giving them some kind of training about, like, here's how you are emotionally intelligent now. I don't know if it works that way, but I think having a lot of honest discussions up front and being really honest about where there's already risk and where there's already opportunity is key. And sometimes that honesty is really, really hard for people. Mm-hmm. They have to really, really trust you to be comfortable speaking that, because, you know, it could sound like you're blaming somebody else or blaming yourself or saying the work is deficient in some way, when that's not always the case. Sometimes you just have, you know, new information later on.
So I really kind of carry on through Leah's question there about how, like, training. You know, it occurs to me that this is the perfect kind of exercise for those things where companies take their staff to go do stuff, retreats or whatever. That this would be a good, this would be a good theme for a retreat. But I really appreciated in the article you wrote for Medium where you sort of broke down a couple characteristics of emotional intelligence. And I feel like me just reading it gave me a little fodder for how I could spend time with myself to try and heighten my awareness of these things. And the first one that you mentioned is just the self-awareness to start. Like, you need to be aware that what you said earlier, your experiences are not other people's experiences. Yeah. And if that's your starting point, I feel like that's already the beginning of trying to bring emotional intelligence into your process. If you just take that moment to really check yourself and remind you of who you are and where you fit in the world, and that everything you think isn't what everyone else kind of thinks. But I feel like those characteristics are all things that we could individually reflect upon too on ourselves before we begin or during the design or development of something as sort of just a regular check. Are you still coming from this place of understanding that you have to be empathetic, that you have to communicate clearly, you have to be transparent, you have to question not only your motivations, but what the motivations of the people you're building something for are. So I thought that was also very useful, maybe not for training, but just for helping yourself put yourself in the right mindset.
Yeah, I think also one of the most important things I've learned along those lines, just as a designer in general, not even just about emotional intelligence, is about responsibility. One of the things I've noticed in my career, you know, I kind of have always followed just what's interesting to me. So, you know, I was an illustrator, and then I started designing, like, semantic markup and got really excited about that. And I wanted to do more, like, UI work. And then I got into usability. So I kind of, like, chased that dragon for a while. And I was, like, changing roles both to follow what was interesting and also because I was like, oh, well, I need to go to a place that values user testing and then everything will be great. And what I realized was, you know, nobody's going to let you do your job. Like, it's your responsibility to articulate what that is, what good design process is, what is important to the users, because it's not always clear to everybody else. They might not be designers. They might just be thinking about the problem in a different way. And it's kind of hard, especially if you're younger, to know when to trust your gut, maybe when something isn't quite right or you're missing something in the process, especially when you're working against really hard deadlines. It's hard to be the person that's kind of sounding the alarm and saying, hey, let's back up. Maybe that deadline is less important than this thing. And so it took me, you know, really a decade to be more comfortable doing that. But I think that's something that if people just kind of have that in the background of their minds, like what is their responsibility to the people that they're building for? And what is their responsibility to the people that they're working with, right? Because there have been times where that's been a really difficult thing to do. But in the end, people really appreciate it. You know, it might be hard to begin with, but later they're always really, really glad that they did the right thing and that somebody showed them what that was.
So I'm curious, you're talking about people's hesitations, like how they might not necessarily have buy-in. Like, what are the common concerns people have when you start approaching things to be more emotionally intelligent? And I mean, they just don't think that it's worth investing time in emotionally intelligent design.
You know, I think that you could abstract this as sort of any design problem in a large organization, right? Like there's always this thing that you're going to think is really valuable, whether it's like making something look better or working slightly better. And maybe the cross-functional people you're working with in your organization just have a different idea about what's important to them. Like maybe what's important to them is speed and maybe it's revenue. So the thing that you're pushing is always at odds with them, right? So I feel like every designer has struggled with that kind of issue at some point in time. They're like, I have this thing that's really important and I can't get somebody else to care. I mean, it's not because the other person is mean. They just like are having a hard time seeing your perspective. So something that has worked well for me is one, if you can show the numbers, which that gets into kind of dangerous territory too, because you can't quantify emotional intensity, right? So you might look at your numbers and say, well, all of these people are having a really great experience. So if like 0.1% of people aren't, who cares? But like, how bad is the experience for that 0.1% of people compared to maybe how incrementally good the other experience is? But sometimes you can use numbers to show the way. So something that I worked on, you know, we had this experience and people were like, well, how many people are really being affected by this? And I was like, well, that's a really good question. So I did some more digging and I had to enlist a lot of people who are like data scientists and have access to much more stuff than I do to answer this question. But what we found is that percentage-wise, it seemed like a small amount of people were being affected. But in terms of volume, it was more than the number of Facebook employees that exist. So when somebody is confronted with a number like that, like it's kind of hard for them to say that it's not a problem worth solving. And then there's also something to be said for like showing and not telling, right? Like, any business partner that sat in that user test with me where the woman was crying because of her credit score, they knew immediately, like, we can't do this. You know, people have hearts and, you know, they can't always be there in a user test, but you're usually recording that stuff. So like just showing how somebody's actually interacting with something, I think, is really powerful. And I also think, you know, sometimes you have to go a little bit rogue. And what I mean by that is if you're trying to gain support for something that you haven't done yet, sometimes you have to show somebody what that could look like for them to really get it. Because we sort of as designers take for granted that when we talk about something, we can see a really clear picture in our head of what that looks like. And not everybody can do that. So when I was trying to plan my projects for the upcoming year and I had this thing that I really cared about, I just went and I mocked it up and I brought that to my meeting and people were like, oh, this is what you've been talking about all along. Yeah, I totally get it now. And I've even had to do that with things that like aren't emotionally related. Like when I was working at Progressive, I could see that mobile was this really big shift that was coming. And this was when the first iPhone was out. So people didn't have their phones quite as integrated into their lives as they do now. But we could see the tides were turning, right? Like a lot of more people were paying their insurance on their phone because it was easy and on the go. And I'm like, we need to make a better phone version of this. And like people were like, no, that's going to be really expensive. It's going to take forever. And I'm like, well, there's this magical thing called mobile style sheets. And we can just like strip away all the stuff people don't need and make this really streamlined experience. So I wrote the code and hosted it on my own personal server because I couldn't get a dev sandbox. And then a coworker and I, we'd started this like Skunkworks team, we couldn't get any devices to test on. So we went to the Verizon store and pulled up my like hard-coded files with this stuff to see how it worked on a bunch of different devices. And we took pictures of it and we brought this back to our stakeholders and we're like, look, this thing is pretty much done already. You just need to give us a day to flip some switches and push this out into production. And people were like, well, it's already done, so we may as well do it. And, you know, things changed. They saw a lot more people wanted to use their mobile services and they've really doubled down on that now. So I think sometimes you have to not be afraid to one, put the work in to like get your hands a little dirty and also maybe like step out of your lane a little bit, which people don't always like. But I think when they see something really valuable in the end, they don't really mind that you've done that.
I think that advice is just really good design and development advice period, whenever you're talking to a bunch of stakeholders that might not be as technical, or you're talking to executives who might not necessarily have the vision. Like you mentioned, when the first iPhone came out, not everybody possibly understood what the next steps were, that you need to do the show, not just tell.
Yeah, that's kind of part of our responsibility as designers, right? Like, this is how we get buy-in for anything with the people that we work with. Like, a picture is very, very powerful. That's why people put a premium on our skills. And sometimes we think that we can just ask people for what we want and that they should say yes because we're the designer. And, you know, we have to do the work to build some trust, and showing something tangible does that. I think you cannot say enough for how important building trust is when you're working with like a large and cross-functional organization. That's like the bridge that you have to build to do less work to do the right thing, like later on. Like, once you've sort of shown somebody these examples of your vision several times, you know, when this has been successful and you come to them like 2 years later and you're like, hey, I've got this idea, they're like, all right, let's try it out, because you have a track record.
Yeah, that is a good tip for working in large organizations. And I say that because I didn't do that and was very unhappy in an organization, because I was definitely one of those squeaky wheel types. But I think because of, you know, I just don't think I had the maturity then that I do now, that I was only telling. I never once made the connection that I needed to show why something was important. And I just kept getting frustrated. It never occurred to me to shift what I was doing to try and get buy-in. I just kept expecting everyone else to just shift with me.
Were you just yelling over and over again?
Why? Yeah, just, you know, I've been trying to take my argument to more and more people, but like, I wasn't changing my argument to show numbers or value or anything like that. I think that's really, really an important lesson, that as you become a more mature professional. Leah and I get asked all the time from our clients to give them more data, more information, and we just do it now because we know it makes a difference.
Yeah. And I think like a lot of organizations, just they're very revenue sensitive. So if you can tie the thing that you're trying to do to a true like revenue gain, people are going to be very, very supportive, because that's how business people do their job. You know, that's what they're accountable to. So you have to understand what the goals are of the people that you're working with, and not on like a project by project basis, but like, how do they articulate their success to their boss and their boss's boss? Mm-hmm. And if you know those things and can use your project as a way to help make them successful, they're going to be on board.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things, it's, you know, like you said about how they have to communicate their goals and success to their bosses and stuff. It's also a vocabulary thing. Like, maybe emotional intelligence is not the words you use to describe what you're trying to do. You put it in terms that they relate to, but the bottom line is it achieves both goals at the same time.
Absolutely.
So let's say you've gone with a new product or a new campaign or something, and you intentionally tried to incorporate emotional intelligence into your process with the whole team. How do you evaluate if you are successful or not?
Yeah, I don't quite know yet. My guess would be you put this thing out into the world and you don't hear about anybody having a terrible experience. Now, that predicates itself on a lot of people using your tool and a lot of different kinds of people. But I also think, you know, you can measure some of this stuff before releasing it more broadly by doing a lot of really thorough testing. I mean, you're never going to see everything in testing, but I feel like times where I have planned for a lot of testing in my process have helped me see where things are going to run afoul ahead of time. But you also can collect feedback in your application, right? Like, you see sentiment surveys all over the place. Like, how did you feel about this thing? And I mean, again, you have to be careful because numbers can be interpreted however you want, but you can use combination of qualitative and quantitative tools, right? Like, one of the things we have in the tools that I have. So let me back up. When you work on ads, like I do, one of the controls that you have for users is for them to see why they were served an ad on Facebook. There's literally a thing you can click called, why did I see this ad? And there's an explanation there that tells you, like, here are the things that we use to decide that this ad might be right for you. And we ask you, like, was this explanation useful? And you can tell us yes or no. And we keep track of that. And if it says no too many times, we know that this explanation like isn't really helpful and people aren't necessarily feeling better about ads. So I think that you have to plan measurements in your process too. Like you have to know what is meaningful, what does success look like? Like that's why we talk about that before we even talk about the scope of our projects or what features we're going to build, because then you can work backwards from those goals and build all of like the logging that you need into the application.
So Beth, before we close up, do you have any, you mentioned the, I think it was like the identity choices with Facebook as an example of a positive design where it creates less friction for people. Are there other designs that you've seen out in the world that you think are hitting the right note in terms of creating less friction or a neutral experience?
I don't know if I would say it's neutral, but one of the most impactful things I've seen come out lately, my friend Robin Kanner, she's an awesome designer. You should maybe have her on your podcast sometime. Cool. She designed this project called My Trans Health. And it is really difficult for trans people to find good healthcare and compassionate providers. So she and a partner spent a really long time designing this process that I think just does a really great job because it's solving this really, really, really important need. And it's the tone is spot on. It understands what stress the people going through this process are in and really like cuts through any sort of nonsense to just really get them exactly what they need. I feel like that is like the coolest thing that I have seen happen on the web in a really long time.
And it sounds from what you described that it's kind of like what you were talking before. It's all the different areas from the content to the flow of the app to everything contributing to this frictionless experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's an experience that I think a lot of people just by default like take for granted if they don't have the particular, you know, life that somebody else has. I definitely think that having an emotionally intelligent perspective allows you to do the mundane things that you mentioned. Like, I need to go see a doctor because I'm sick.
Yeah.
Be easier.
Yeah, like, can you imagine using most healthcare websites? Like, they probably have a binary gender option. So, okay, maybe I choose woman, but if I'm not a cisgendered woman, that's going to bias the doctor around what my anatomy is and how they're going to treat me. And so My Trans Health is, I don't think, something that anyone without Robin's perspective could have made. So it also speaks to the importance of diversity and design, too.
Awesome.
So do you have any recommendations for reading or resources that you think can help our listeners kind of round out their mindsets, have more emotional intelligence, more empathy, learning about the importance of those things in design?
I do. And I know I was supposed to send those to you ahead of time and I didn't think about them until this morning. So I'm sorry. But there's two books that I've been recommending in all my talks. The first is Indy Young's Practical Empathy. So I think empathy has been this big buzzword, but people don't really know what it means. They conflate it in sympathy. And empathy is really about improving your listening skills. So Indy's book really hits at how you as a designer and researcher can really do that and kind of strip away your own biases. And the other is Eric Meyer and Sarah, I cannot pronounce her last name, but I want to give her full credit for this. Sarah's book called Design for Real Life. It's a book made by A Book Apart. I mean, I feel like that is probably the most important design book that has come out in the last year. And it talks a lot about, Eric calls these stress cases and not edge cases. And I feel like that should be required reading for like every designer.
Oh, fantastic. I feel like this is such an important episode and I hope this really resonates with our listeners because there's so much practical, personal, and professional benefits putting all of this in place in, you know, your day to day.
And it will affect all of us one way or another. Like all of us are going to have our own experiences. And the more and more we're engaging with technology and apps and sites and devices, the more these things are going to become important. And so the lessons that we're learning now will help all of us have better experiences online.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think what I was saying before is kind of the apps start to become personified as you use them.
Right.
And if your app were a person, what would you want somebody to say about their interaction with that person when they walk away from it? Like you would want them to feel like they were respected and valued and listened to and not like they were, you know, pushed around.
Oh, it's a perfect note to end on. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions. so our listeners
so bad at these.
Can get to know you a bit better. Oh, it's going to be fun. Okay, are you ready?
All right, I'm braced.
Okay, all right. First question, morning person or night owl?
Oh, it depends. I really want to be a morning person, but my body's usually a night owl.
What's one of your guilty pleasures?
Pizza? I don't feel that guilty about that, though.
Nice. What software could you not live without?
I feel like I could live without a lot of software. I use Sketch every day, for better or for worse. It's full of bugs, but I rely on it to do my job.
What profession other than your own would you like to try?
Sometimes I think about selling all of my belongings and becoming a mountain guide. And other times I wish that if life had gone a different direction, I would be like a museum taxidermist or one of the people that paints the backgrounds for the dioramas in the Smithsonian.
Oh, very cool. What profession would you not like to try?
I wouldn't want to be a veterinarian. I thought that I did when I was a little girl and I shadowed one and watched them neuter a dog, and that was enough for me.
I had the same experience as a child.
It was brutal.
Yeah, I wanted to be a vet my whole thing, and then I got some sort of opportunity to see a surgery. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea, but I don't want to be a vet anymore. If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
Probably the Tonga Room. The Tonga Room is a historic bar in the Fairmont Hotel, housed on what used to be the hotel pool, and the pool is still there. It's a tiki bar and restaurant, and there's a band that floats out on a raft every hour, and a rainstorm falls on them, and they play really bad music like you're at some terrible bar mitzvah.
And what kind of food is it? Is it like Caribbean?
It's sort of like fake Polynesian. You know, they redid the menu a few years ago and they upgraded. So it used to be kind of like Panda Express and now it's more like P.F. Chang's. But like the drinks are really what it's all about. The drinks are phenomenal now.
Very cool. If you could meet someone famous, living or dead, who would it be?
Oh, no, I'm not prepared for that at all. I think I would pick the lady behind Ask a Mortician, the YouTube series. She wrote a book too called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Yeah, she's pretty cool. I'd like to meet her.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
To be invisible.
What is your favorite band or musician?
Wow. I don't know. That depends on the day. It could be so many different things. I think probably if you were to look at my record collection, most of it is like 60s soul and girl group. So something in there. Probably the Ronettes. You know, my all-time favorite record is the Ronettes' Be My Baby. So let's go with that. I'll double down there.
All right, last question. Pancakes or waffles?
French toast.
Nice.
Your second French toast answer, I think.
No, I was actually just being contrarian. I think chocolate chip pancakes, probably.
Awesome. Perfect. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show again, Beth.
Thanks, ladies.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Probably the best place to get at me is on Twitter. And my handle on Twitter is just my name, Beth Dean.
Great. Thanks again, Beth. It was great having you back on the show.
Thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Visual Chefs.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech and Devotee.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you liked this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. And if you really like this episode, consider donating to the show. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we're going to talk about data-driven design with Matthew Oliphant. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site at controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.